He introduced him and then quickly got back to his questions for the paramedics. Where was the father when you got there?
They had the kid on the floor by the back door where he had brought him in. Father was sort of collapsed on the floor next to him, screaming and crying like they do, kicking the floor.
Did he ever say anything?
Not right then.
Then when?
When we made the decision to transport and work on the kid in the truck, he wanted to go. We told him he couldn't. We told him to get somebody from the office to drive him.
What were his words?
He just said, "I want to go with him, I want to be with my son," stuff like that.
Furris shook his head as if in pain. At any time, did he talk about what had happened? Bosch asked. Tikkanen checked his partner, who shook his head.
No, Tikkanen said, he didn't.
Then how were you informed of what had happened?
Well, initially we heard it from dispatch. Then one of the office workers, a lady, she told us when we got there. She led us to the back and told us along the way.
Bosch thought he had all he was going to get, but then thought of something else. You didn't happen to take an exterior air temperature reading for that spot, did you? The two paramedics looked at each other and then at Bosch.
Didn't think to, Tikkanen said. But it's gotta be at least 95 with the Santa Ana's kicking up like this. I don't remember a June this hot.
Bosch remembered a June he had spent in a jungle, but wasn't going to get into it. He thanked the paramedics and let them get back to duty. He put his notebook away and looked at his partner.
Okay, tell me about the scene, he said.
We've got to charge this guy, Harry, Furris said urgently.
Why? What did you find?
It's not what I found. It's because it was just a kid, Harry. What kind of father would let this happen? How could he forget?
Furris had become a father for the first time 6 months earlier. Bosch knew this. The experience had made him a professional dad, and every Monday he came into the squad with a new batch of photos. To Bosch, the kid looked the same week to week, but not to Furris. He was in love with being a father, with having a son.
Ignacio, you've got to separate your own feelings about it from the facts and the evidence, okay? You know this. Calm down.
I know. It's just that... How could he forget, you know?
Yeah, I know.
And we're going to keep that in mind. So tell me what you found out over there.
Who'd you talk to?
The office manager.
And what did he say?
It's a lady. She said that he came in through the back door shortly after 10. All the sales agents park in the back and use the back door. That's why nobody saw the kid. The father came in talking on the cell phone. Then he got off and asked if he'd gotten a fax, but there was no fax. So he made another call, and she heard him ask where the fax was. Then he waited for the fax.
How long did he wait?
She said not long, but the fax was an offer to buy. So he called the client, and that started a whole back and forth with calls and faxes, and he completely forgot about the kid. It was at least 2 hours, Harry. 2 hours!
Bosch could almost share his partner's anger, but he had been on the mission a couple of decades longer than Furris, and knew how to hold it in when he had to, and when to let it go.
Harry, something else, too.
What?
The baby had something wrong with him.
The manager saw the kid?
No, I mean always, since birth. She said it was a big tragedy. The kid was handicapped. Blind, deaf, a bunch of things wrong. 15 months old and he couldn't walk or talk, and never could even crawl. He just cried a lot.
Bosch nodded as he tried to plug this information into everything else he knew and had accumulated. Just then, another car came speeding into the parking lot. It pulled into the ambulance chute in front of the ER doors. A woman leaped out and ran into the ER, leaving the car running and the door open.
That's probably the mother, Bosch said. We better get in there.
Bosch started trotting toward the ER doors, and Furris followed. They went through the ER waiting room and down a hallway where the father had been placed in a private room to wait. As Bosch got close, he did not hear any screaming or crying or fists on flesh, things that wouldn't have surprised him. The
The door was open, and when he turned in, he saw the parents of the dead boy embracing each other, but not a tear lined any of their cheeks. Bosch's initial split-second reaction was that he was seeing relief in their young faces. They separated when they saw Bosch enter, followed by Furris.
"Mr. and Mrs. Helton?" he asked.
They nodded in unison, but the man corrected Bosch. "I am Stephen Helton, and this is my wife, Arlene Haddon.
I'm Detective Bosch with the Los Angeles Police Department, and this is my partner, Detective Furris. We are very sorry for the loss of your son. It is our job now to investigate William's death and to learn exactly what happened to him."
Helton nodded as his wife stepped close to him and put her face into his chest. Something silent was transmitted.
"Does this have to be done now?" Helton asked. "We've just lost our beautiful little..."
"Yes, sir, it has to be done now. This is a homicide investigation."
"It was an accident," Helton weakly protested. "It's all my fault, but it was an accident."
"It's still a homicide investigation. We would like to speak to each of you privately, without the intrusions that will occur here. Do you mind coming down to the police station to be interviewed?"
"We'll leave him here?"
"The hospital is making arrangements for your son's body to be moved to the medical examiner's office."
"They're going to cut him open?"
the mother asked in a near hysterical voice. "They will examine his body and then determine if an autopsy is necessary," Bosch said. "It is required by law that any untimely death fall under the jurisdiction of the medical examiner." He waited to see if there was further protest. When there wasn't, he stepped back and gestured for them to leave the room. "We'll drive you down to Parker Center, and I promise to make this as painless as possible." They placed the grieving parents in separate interview rooms in the third-floor offices of Homicide Special. Because it was Sunday, the cafeteria was closed, and Bosch had to make do with the vending machines in the alcove by the elevators. He got a can of Coke and two packages of cheese crackers. He had not eaten breakfast before being called in on the case, and was now famished. He took his time while eating the crackers and talking things over with Furris. He wanted both Helton and Haddon to believe that they were waiting while the other spouse was being interviewed. It was a trick of the trade, part of the strategy. Each would have to wonder what the other was saying.
"Okay," Bosch finally said. "I'm going to go in and take the husband. You can watch in the booth, or you can take a run at the wife. Your choice."
It was a big moment. Bosch was more than 25 years ahead of Furris on the job. He was the mentor, and Furris was the student. So far in their fledgling partnership, Bosch had not let Furris conduct a formal interview. He was allowing that now, and the look on Furris's face showed that it was not lost on him.
"You're going to let me talk to her?"
"Sure, why not? You can handle it."
"All right if I get in the booth and watch you with him first? That way you can watch me?"
"Whatever makes you comfortable."
"Thanks, Harry."
"Don't thank me, Ignacio. Thank yourself. You earned it."
Bosch dumped the empty cracker packages and the can in a trash can near his desk. "Do me a favor," he said. "Go on the internet first and check the LA Times to see if they've had any stories lately about a case like this. You know, with a kid? I'd be curious. And if there are, we might be able to make a play with the story. Use it like a prop."
"I'm on it."
"I'll go set up the video in the booth."
10 minutes later, Bosch entered interview room 3, where Stephen Helton was waiting for him. Helton looked like he was not quite 30 years old. He was lean and tan, and appeared to be the perfect real estate salesman. He didn't look like he had ever spent even 5 minutes in a police station before. Immediately, he protested.
"What is taking so long? I've just lost my son, and you stick me in this room for an hour? Is that procedure?"
"It hasn't been that long, Stephen. But I am sorry you had to wait. We were talking to your wife,
and that went longer than we thought it would.
Why were you talking to her? Willie was with me the whole time.
We talked to her for the same reason we're talking to you. I'm sorry for the delay.
Bosch pulled out the chair that was across the small table from Helton and sat down.
First of all, he said, thank you for coming in for the interview.
You understand that you are not under arrest or anything like that. You're free to go if you wish. But by law, we have to conduct an investigation of the death, and we appreciate your cooperation.
I just want to get it over with so I can begin the process.
What process is that?
I don't know. Whatever process you go through. You know, grief and guilt and mourning.
Willie wasn't in our lives very long, but we loved him very much. This is just awful. I made a mistake, and I'm going to pay for it the rest of my life, Detective Bosch.
Bosch almost told him that his son paid for the mistake with the rest of his life, but chose not to antagonize the man. Instead, he just nodded and noted that Helton had looked down at his lap when he had spoken most of his statement. Averting the eyes was a classic tell that indicated untruthfulness. Another tell was that Helton had his hands down in his lap and out of sight. The open and truthful person keeps his hands on the table and in sight.
Why don't we start at the beginning? Bosch said. Tell me how the day started.
Helton nodded and began.
Sunday's our busiest day. We're both in real estate. You may have seen the signs, Haddon and Helton. We're PPG's top volume team. Today, Arlene had an open house at noon and a couple of private showings before that. So Willie was going to be with me. We lost another nanny on Friday, and there was no one else to take him.
How did you lose the nanny?
She quit. They all quit. Willie is a handful, because of his condition. I mean, why deal with a handicapped child if someone with a normal, healthy child will pay the same thing? Consequently, we go through a lot of nannies.
So you were left to take care of the boy today, while your wife had the property showings.
It wasn't like I wasn't working, though. I was negotiating a sale that would have brought in a $30,000 commission. It was important.
Is that why you went into the office?
Exactly. We got an offer sheet, and I was going to have to respond. So I got Willie ready and put him in the car and went into work.
What time was this?
About 9:45. I got the call from the other realtor at about 9:30. The buyer was playing hardball. Response time was going to be set at an hour, so I had to get my seller on standby, pack up Willie, and get in there to pick up the facts.
Do you have a fax at home?
Yes, but if the deal went down, we'd have to get together in the office. We have a signing room, and all the forms are right there. My file on the property was in my office, too.
Bosch nodded. It sounded plausible, to a point.
Okay, so you head off to the office.
Exactly. And two things happened.
Helton brought his hands up into sight, but only to hold them across his face to hide his eyes. A classic tell.
What two things?
I got a call on my cell from Arlene, and Willie fell asleep in his car seat. Do you understand?
Make me understand.
I was distracted by the call, and I was no longer distracted by Willie. He'd fallen asleep.
Uh-huh.
So I forgot he was there. Forgive me, God, but I forgot I had him with me.
I understand. What happened next?
Helton dropped his hands out of sight again. He looked at Bosch briefly, and then at the tabletop.
I parked in my assigned space behind PPG and I went in. I was still talking to Arlene. One of our buyers is trying to get out of a contract because he's found something he likes better. So we were talking about that, about how to finesse things with that, and I was on the phone when I went in.
Okay, I see that. What happened when you went in?
Helton didn't answer right away. He sat there looking at the table as if trying to remember so he could get the answer right.
Stephen, Bosch prompted, what happened next?
I had told the buyer's agent to fax me the offer, but it wasn't there. So I got off the line from my wife, and I called the agent. Then I waited around for the fax, checked my slips, and made a few callbacks while I was waiting.
What are your slips?
Phone messages.
People who see our signs on properties and call. I don't put my cell or home number on the signs.
How many callbacks did you make?
I think just two. I got a message on one and spoke briefly to the other person. My fax came in, and that was what I was there for. I got off the line.
Now, at this point, it was what time?
I don't know, about 10 after 10?
Would you say that at this point you were still cognizant that your son was still in your car, in the parking lot?
Helton took time to think through an answer again, but spoke before Bosch had to prompt him. No, because if I knew he was in the car, I would not have left him in the first place. I forgot about him while I was still in the car. You understand?
Bosch leaned back in his seat. Whether he understood it or not, Helton had just dodged one legal bullet. If he had acknowledged that he knowingly left the boy in the car, even if he planned to be back in a few minutes, that would have greatly supported a charge of negligent homicide. But Helton had maneuvered the question correctly, almost as if he had expected it.
Okay, Bosch said. What happened next?
Helton shook his head wistfully and looked at the side wall as if gazing through a window toward the past he couldn't change.
I got involved in the deal, he said. The fax came in, I called my client, and I faxed back a counter. I also did a lot of talking to the other agent, by phone. We were trying to get the deal done, and we had to handhold both our clients through this.
For 2 hours.
Yes, it took that long.
And when was it that you remembered that you had left William in the car out in the parking lot, where it was about 95 degrees?
I guess as soon as... First of all, I didn't know what the temperature was. I object to that. I left that car at about 10, and it was not 95 degrees, not even close. I hadn't even used the air conditioner on the way over.
There was a complete lack of remorse or guilt in Helton's demeanor. He wasn't even attempting to fake it anymore. Bosch had become convinced that this man had no love or affinity for his damaged and now lost child. William was simply a burden that had to be dealt with, and therefore could easily be forgotten when things like business and selling houses and making money came up. But where was the crime in all of this? Bosch knew he could charge him with negligence, but the courts tend to view the loss of a child as enough punishment in these situations. Helton would go free with his wife as sympathetic figures, free to continue their lives while baby William moldered in his grave. The tells always add up. Bosch instinctively believed Helton was a liar, and he began to believe that William's death was no accident. Unlike his partner, who had let the passions of his own fatherhood lead him down the path, Bosch had come to this point after careful observation and analysis. It was now time to press on, to bait Helton, and see if he would make a mistake.
Is there anything else you want to add at this point to the story? He asked.
Helton let out a deep breath and slowly shook his head.
That's the whole sad story, he said. I wish to God it never happened, but it did.
He looked directly at Bosch for the first time during the entire interview. Bosch held his gaze and then asked a question.
Do you have a good marriage, Stephen?
Helton looked away and stared at the invisible window again.
What do you mean?
I mean, do you have a good marriage? You can say yes or no if you want.
Yes, I have a good marriage, Helton responded emphatically. I don't know what my wife told you, but I think it is very solid. What are you trying to say?
All I'm saying is that sometimes when there is a child with challenges, it strains the marriage. My partner just had a baby. The kid's healthy, but money's tight, and his wife isn't back at work yet. You know the deal. It's tough. I can only imagine what the strain of having a child with William's difficulties would be like.
Yeah, well, we made it by all right.
The nanny's quitting all the time.
It wasn't that hard. Soon as one quits, we put an ad on Craigslist for another.
Bosch nodded and scratched the back of his head. While doing it, he waved a finger in a circular motion toward the camera that was in the air vent up on the wall behind him. Helton could not see him do this.
"When did you two get married?" he asked.
2.5 years ago. We met on a contract. She had the buyer and I had the seller. We worked well together. We started talking about joining forces, and then we realized we were in love.
Then William came.
Yes, that's right.
That must have changed things.
It did.
So when Arlene was pregnant, couldn't the doctors tell that he had these problems?
They could have if they had seen him. But Arlene's a workaholic. She was busy all the time. She missed some appointments and the ultrasounds. When they discovered there was a problem, it was too late.
Do you blame your wife for that?
Helton looked aghast. No, of course not. Look, what does this have to do with what happened today? I mean, why are you asking me all of this?
Bosch leaned across the table. It may have a lot to do with it, Stephen. I am trying to determine what happened today and why. The why is the tough part.
It was an accident. I forgot he was in the car, okay? I will go to my grave knowing that my mistake killed my own son. Isn't that enough for you?
Bosch leaned back and said nothing. He hoped Helton would say more.
Do you have a son, Detective? Any children?
A daughter.
Yeah. Well then, happy Father's Day. I'm really glad for you. I hope you never have to go through what I'm going through right now. Believe me, it's not fun.
Bosch had forgotten it was Father's Day. The realization knocked him off his rhythm, and his thoughts went to his daughter, living 8,000 miles away. In her 10 years, he had only been with her on one Father's Day. What did that say about him? Here he was trying to get inside another father's actions and motivations, and he knew his own could not stand equal scrutiny. The moment ended when there was a knock on the door, and Ferris came in carrying a file.
"Excuse me," he said, "I thought you might want to see this."
He handed the file to Bosch and left the room. Bosch turned the file on the table in front of them and opened it so that Helton would not be able to see its contents. Inside was a computer printout and a handwritten note on a post-it. The note said, "No ad on Craigslist." The printout was of a story that ran in the LA Times 10 months earlier. It was about the heat-stroke death of a child who had been left in a car in Lancaster while his mother ran into a store to buy milk. She ran into the middle of a robbery. She was tied up along with the store clerk and placed in a back room. The robbers ransacked the store and escaped. It was an hour before the victims were discovered and freed, but by then the child in the car had already succumbed to heat stroke. Bosch scanned the story quickly, then dropped the file closed. He looked at Helton without speaking.
"What?" Helton asked.
"Just some additional information and lab reports," he lied.
"Do you get the LA Times, by the way?"
"Yes, why?"
"Just curious, that's all."
"Now, how many nannies do you think you've employed in the 15 months that William was alive?"
Helton shook his head.
"I don't know. At least 10. They don't stay long. They can't take it."
"And then you go to Craigslist to place an ad?"
"Yes."
"And you just lost a nanny on Friday?"
"Yes, I told you."
"She just walked out on you?"
"No, she got another job and told us she was leaving. She made up a lie about it being closer to home and with gas prices and all of that. But we knew why she was leaving. She could not handle Willie."
"She told you this Friday?"
"No, when she gave notice."
"When was that?"
"She gave 2 weeks' notice, so it was 2 weeks back from Friday."
"And do you have a new nanny lined up?"
"No, not yet. We were still looking."
"But you put the feelers out and ran the ad again, that sort of thing."
"Right, but listen, what does this have to—"
"Let me ask the question, Stephen. Your wife told us that she worried about leaving William with you, that you couldn't handle the strain of it." Helton looked shocked. The statement came from left field, as Bosch had wanted it.
What? Why would she say that?
I don't know. Is it true?
No, it's not true.
She told us she was worried that this wasn't an accident.
That's absolutely crazy, and I doubt she said it. You are lying.
He turned in his seat so that the front of his body faced the corner of the room, and he would have to turn his face to look directly at Bosch. Another tell. Bosch knew he was zeroing in. He decided it was the right time to gamble.
She mentioned a story you found in the L.A. Times that was about a kid left in a car up in Lancaster. The kid died of heat stroke. She was worried that it gave you the idea.
Elton swiveled in his seat and leaned forward to put his elbows on the table and run his hands through his hair.
Oh, my God, I can't believe she...
He didn't finish. Bosch knew his gamble had paid off. Elton's mind was racing along the edge. It was time to push him over.
You didn't forget that William was in the car, did you, Stephen?
Elton didn't answer. He buried his face in his hands again. Bosch leaned forward so that he only had to whisper.
You left him there, and you knew what was going to happen. You planned it. That's why you didn't bother running ads for a new nanny. You knew you weren't going to need one.
Elton remained silent and unmoving. Bosch kept working him, changing tacks and offering sympathy now.
It's understandable, he said. I mean, what kind of life would that kid have anyway? Some might even call this a mercy killing. The kid falls asleep and never wakes up. I've worked these kinds of cases before, Stephen. It's actually not a bad way to go. It sounds bad, but it isn't. You just get tired and you go to sleep.
Elton kept his face in his hands, but he shook his head. Bosch didn't know if he was denying it still or shaking off something else. He waited, and the delay paid off.
It was her idea,
Elton said in a quiet voice.
She's the one who couldn't take it anymore.
In that moment, Bosch knew he had him, but he showed nothing. He kept working it.
Wait a minute, he said.
She said she had nothing to do with it, that this was your idea and your plan, and that when she called you, it was to talk you out of it.
Elton dropped his hands with a slap on the table.
That's a lie! It was her! She was embarrassed that we had a kid like that. She couldn't take him anywhere, and we couldn't go anywhere. He was ruining our lives! And she told me I had to do something about it. She told me how to do something about it. She said I would be saving two lives while sacrificing only one.
Bosch pulled back across the table. It was done. It was over.
Okay, Stephen, I think I understand. And I want to hear all about it. But at this point, I need to inform you of your rights. After that, if you want to talk, we'll talk and I'll listen.
When Bosch came out of the interview room, Ignacio Ferris was there waiting for him in the hallway. His partner raised his fist, and Bosch tapped his knuckles with his own fist.
That was beautiful, Ferris said. You walked him right down the road.
Thanks, Bosch said. Let's hope the DA is impressed, too.
I don't think we'll have to worry.
Well, there will be no worries if you go into the other room and turn the wife now.
Ferris looked surprised.
You still want me to take the wife?
She's yours.
Let's walk them into the DA as bookends.
I'll do my best.
Good.
Go check the equipment and make sure we're still recording in there. I've got to make a quick call.
You got it, Harry. Bosch walked into the squad room and sat down at his desk. He checked his watch and knew it would be early in Hong Kong. He pulled out his cell phone anyway and sent a call across the Pacific. His daughter answered with a cheerful hello. Bosch knew he wouldn't even have to say anything, and he would feel fulfilled by just the sound of her voice saying the one word.
Hey, baby, it's me, he said.
Daddy, she exclaimed. Happy Father's Day!
And Bosch realized in that moment that he was indeed a happy man. angle of investigation. Then.
This is all because of Manson, Eckersley said. Bosch looked across the seat at his training partner, unsure of what he meant.
Charles Manson?
You know, Helter Skelter and all of that shit, Eckersley explained.
They're still scared.
Bosch nodded, though he still didn't get it. He looked out the windshield. They were heading south on Vermont, through territory unfamiliar to him. It was only his second day with Eckersley, and his second on the job. Almost all of the neighborhoods in Wilshire were unfamiliar to him, but that was okay. Eckersley had been working patrol in the division for 4 years. He knew the neighborhoods.
Somebody doesn't answer the phone, and back east they think Squeaky and the rest of Charlie's girls have broken in and chopped them up or something, Eckersley continued. We get a lot of these check-the-lady calls. 4 years now, and people still think L.A.'s been turned over to the nuts.
Bosch had been away from the world when Manson and his people had done their thing, so he didn't have a proper read on what the murders had done to the city. When he had come back from Vietnam, he had felt an edginess in L.A. and had not been there before he left. But he didn't know whether that was because of the changes he had been through or the ones the city had been through. South of Santa Monica, they took a left on 4th Street, and Bosch started reading numbers off of mailboxes. In a few seconds, Eckersley pulled the squad car to a stop in front of a small bungalow with a driveway down the side to a single garage in the back. They both got out, Bosch taking his nightstick out of the plastic pipe on the door and sliding it into the ring on his equipment belt.
You won't need that, Eckersley said, unless you want to use it to knock on the door.
Bosch turned back to the car to put the club back.
Come on, come on, Eckersley said. I didn't tell you to put it back, I just said you wouldn't need it.
Bosch hustled to catch up to him on the flagstone walkway leading to the front door. He walked with both hands on his belt. He was still getting used to the weight and the awkward bulk of it. When he was in Vietnam, his job had been to go into the tunnels. He'd kept his body profile as trim as possible. No equipment belt. He carried all of his equipment, a flashlight and a .45, in his hands. Eckersley had sat out the war in a patrol car. He was 8 years older than Bosch, and had that many years on the job. He was taller and heavier than Bosch, and carried the weight and bulk of his equipment belt with a practiced ease. He signaled to Bosch to knock on the front door, as if that took training. Bosch knocked 3 times with his fist.
Like this, Eckersley corrected. He rapped sharply on the door. Police, Mrs. Wilkins, can you come to the door, please?
His fist and voice had a certain authority, a tone. That was what he was trying to teach his rookie partner. Bosch nodded. He understood the lesson. He looked around and saw that the windows were all closed, even though it was a nice, cool morning. Nobody answered the door.
You smell that? He asked Eckersley.
Smell what?
The one area where Bosch didn't need any training from Eckersley was in the smell of death. He had spent 2 tours in the dead zone. In the tunnels, the enemy put their dead into the walls. Death was always in the air.
Somebody's dead, Bosch said. I'll check around back.
He stepped off the front porch and took the driveway to the rear of the property. The odor was stronger back here, to Bosch at least. The dispatcher on the radio had said June Wilkins lived alone and hadn't answered phone calls from her daughter in Philadelphia for 7 days. There was a small enclosed yard with a clothesline stretching from the corner of the garage to the corner of the house. There were a few things hanging on the line, 2 silk slips and other women's undergarments. There were more clothing items on the ground, having fallen or been blown off the line. The winds came up at night. People didn't leave their clothes on the line overnight. Bosch went to the garage first and stood on his toes to look through one of the 2 windows set high in the wooden door. He saw the distinctive curving roofline of a Volkswagen Beetle inside. The car and the clothing left out on the line seemed to confirm what the odor already told him. June Wilkins had not left on a trip, simply forgetting to tell her daughter back east. She was inside the house, waiting for them. He turned to the house and went up the three concrete steps to the back door stoop. There was a glass panel in the door that allowed him to see into the kitchen and partway down a hallway that led to the front rooms of the house. Nothing seemed amiss. No rotting food on the table, no blood on the floor. He then saw on the floor next to a trash can a dog food bowl with flies buzzing around the rotting mound inside it. Bosch felt a quickening of his pulse. He took his stick out and used it to rap on the glass. He waited, but there was no response. He heard his partner knock on the front door again and announce once more that it was the police. Bosch tried the knob on the back door and found it unlocked. He slowly opened the door, and the odor came out with an intensity that made him drop back off the stoop. "Ron!" he called out. "Open door in the back!" After a moment, he could hear his partner's equipment belt jangling as he hustled to the back, his footfalls heavy. He came around the corner to the stoop.
"Did you... Oh, shit. That is rank. I mean, that is bad. We've got a DB in there."
Bosch nodded. He assumed DB meant dead body.
"Should we go in?"
he asked.
"Yeah, we better check it out," Eckersley said. "But wait a second."
He went over to the clothesline and yanked the two slips off the line. He threw one to Bosch.
"Use that," he said.
Eckersley bunched the silk slip up against his mouth and nose and went first through the door. Bosch did the same and followed him in.
"Let's do this quick," Eckersley said in a muffled voice.
They moved with speed through the house and found the DB in the bathroom off the hallway. There was a clawfoot bathtub filled to the brim with still dark water. Breaking the surface were two rounded shapes at either end, with hair splayed out in the water. Flies had collected on each as if they were lifeboats on the sea.
"Let me see your stick," Eckersley said.
Not comprehending, Bosch pulled it out of his belt ring and handed it to his partner. Eckersley dipped one end of the stick into the tub's dark water and prodded the round shape near the foot of the tub. The flies dispersed, and Bosch waved them away from his face. The object in the water shifted its delicate balance and turned over. Bosch saw the jagged teeth and snout of a dog break the surface. He involuntarily took a step back. Eckersley moved to the next shape. He probed it with a stick, and the flies angrily took flight, but the object in the water did not move so readily. It was not free-floating like the dog. It went down deep, like an iceberg. He dipped the stick down farther and then raised it. The misshapen and decaying face of a human being came up out of the water. The small features and long hair suggested a woman, but that could not be determined for sure by what Bosch saw. The stick had found leverage below the dead person's chin, but it quickly slipped off and the face submerged again. Dark water lapped over the side of the tub, and both the police officers stepped back again.
"Let's get out of here," Eckersley said, "or we'll never get it out of our noses."
He handed the nightstick back to Bosch and pushed past him to the door.
"Wait a second," Bosch said.
But Eckersley didn't wait. Bosch turned his attention back to the body and dipped the stick into the dark water again. He pulled it through the water until it hooked something, and he raised it up. The dead person's hands came out of the water. They were bound at the wrists with a dog collar. He slowly let them back down into the water again. On his way out of the house, Bosch carried the stick at arm's length from his body. In the backyard, he found Eckersley standing by the garage door, gulping down fresh air. Bosch threw the slip he had used to breathe through over the clothesline and came over.
"Congratulations, Boot,"
Eckersley said, using the department slang for rookie.
"You got your first DB. Stick with the job and it'll be one of many."
Bosch didn't say anything. He tossed his nightstick onto the grass. He planned to get a new one now, and took out his cigarettes.
"What do you think?" Eckersley asked. "Suicide? She took the pooch with her?"
"Her hands were tied with the dog's collar," Bosch said. Eckersley's mouth opened a little,
but then he recovered and became the training officer again.
You shouldn't have gone fishing in there, he said sternly. Suicide or homicide is not our concern anymore. Let the detectives handle it from here.
Bosch nodded his contrition and agreement.
What I don't get, his partner said, is how the hell did you smell that at the front door?
Bosch shrugged. Used to it, I guess. He nodded toward the west as if the war had been just down the street.
I guess that also explains why you're not puking your guts out, Eckersley said, like most rookies would be doing right now.
I guess so.
You know what, Bosch? Maybe you got a nose for this stuff.
Maybe I do.
Now, Harry Bosch and his partner Kiz Ryder shared an alcove in the back corner of the open unsolved unit in Parker Center. Their desks were pushed together so they could face each other and discuss case matters without having to talk loudly and bother the six other detectives in the squad. Ryder was writing on her laptop, entering the completion and summary reports on the Verloren case. Bosch was reading through the dusty pages of a blue binder known as a murder book.
Anything?
Ryder asked without looking up from her screen.
Bosch was reviewing the murder book since it was the next case they would work together. He hadn't chosen it at random. It involved the 1972 slaying of June Wilkins. Bosch had been a patrolman then and had been on the job only 2 days when he and his partner at the time had discovered the body of the murdered woman in her bathtub, along with the body of her dog. Both had been held underwater and drowned. There were thousands of unsolved murders in the files of the Los Angeles Police Department. To justify the time and cost of mounting a new investigation, there had to be a hook, something that could be sent through the forensic databases in search of a match. Fingerprints, ballistics, DNA. That was what Ryder was asking. Had he found a hook?
Not yet, he answered.
Then why don't you quit fooling with it and skip to the back?
She wanted him to skip to the evidence report in the back of the binder and see if there was anything that could fit the bill. But Bosch wanted to take his time. He wanted to know all the details of the case. It had been his first DB, one of many that would come to him in the department. But he had no part in the investigation. He had been a rookie patrolman at the time. He had to watch the detectives work it. It would be years in the department before it was his turn to speak for the dead.
I just want to see what they did, he tried to explain. See how they worked it. Most of these cases, they could have should have been cleared back in the day.
Well, you have till I'm finished with this summary, Ryder cautioned. After that, we better get flying on something, Harry.
Bosch blew out his breath in mock indignation and flipped a large section of summaries and other reports over in the binder until he got to the back. He then turned to the tab marked Forensics and looked at an evidence inventory report.
Okay, we've got latents. You happy?
Ryder looked up from her computer for the first time.
That could work, she said. Tied to the suspect?
Bosch flipped back to the evidence report to look for the summary ascribed to the specific evidence logged in the inventory. He found a one-paragraph explanation that said a right palm print had been located on the wall of the bathroom where the body had been found. Its location was 66 inches from the floor and 7 inches right of center above the toilet.
Well,
what?
It's a palm. She groaned. It was not a good hook. Databases containing palm prints were relatively new in law enforcement. Only in the past decade had palm prints been seriously collected by the FBI and the California Department of Justice. In California, there were approximately 10,000 palms on file, compared with the millions of fingerprints. The Wilkins murder was 33 years old. What were the chances that the person who had left a palm print on the wall of the victim's bathroom
would be printed 2 decades or more later. Ryder had answered that one with her groan.
It's still worth a shot, Bosch said optimistically. I'll put in the SID request.
You do that. Meantime, as soon as I'm done here, I'll see if I can find a case with a real hook we can run with.
Hold your horses, Kiz.
I still haven't run any of the names out of the book.
Give me today with this, and then we'll see.
Not good to get emotionally involved, Harry, she responded. The Laura syndrome, you know.
It's not like that. I'm just curious.
It was sort of my first case.
No, it wasn't. You know what I mean.
I remember thinking she was an old lady when the detectives gave me the rundown on it. But she was only 46. I was half her age, so I thought anybody 46 was old, and I had a good run of it. I didn't feel too bad about it.
Now you do. 46 was too young, Kiz.
Well, you're not going to bring her back.
Bosch nodded. I know that.
You ever seen that movie?
Laura? Yeah, I've seen it. Detective falls in love with the murder victim. You?
Yeah, but it doesn't hold up too well. Sort of a parlor room murder case.
I like the Burt Reynolds take on it in the 80s, Sharkey's Machine, with Rachel Ward. You seen it?
I don't think so.
Had Bernie Casey in it. When I was a youngster, I always thought he was a fine-looking man.
Bosch looked at her with a raised eyebrow.
Before I switched teams, she said. Then I rented it a couple years ago, and Bernie didn't do it for me. I liked Rachel Ward.
Her bringing up her sexuality seemed to put an uneasiness between them. She turned back to her computer. Bosch looked down at the evidence report.
Well, we know one thing, he said after a while. We're looking for a left-handed man.
She turned back to look at him.
How do you know that?
He put his right hand on the wall over the toilet.
And?
It's just like a gun, Kiz. He aimed with his left hand because he's left-handed.
She shook her head dismissively.
Men.
She went back to work on her computer, and Bosch went back to the murder book.
He wrote down the information he would need to give to the latent print section of the Scientific Investigation Division in order for a tech to look up the palm print in their files. He then asked if Ryder wanted him to pick her up a coffee or a soda from the cafeteria while he was floating around the building. She said no, and he was off. He took the murder book with him.
Bosch filled out the comparison request forms and gave them to a print tech named Larkin. He was one of the older, more experienced techs. Bosch had gone to him before and knew that he would move quickly with the request.
Let's hope we hit the jackpot, Harry, Larkin said as he took the forms.
It was true that there was always a sense of excitement when you put an old print into a computer and let it ride. It was like pulling the lever on a slot machine. The jackpot payoff was a match, a cold hit in police parlance. After leaving SID, Bosch went to the cafeteria for a cup of coffee and to finish reading through the murder book. He decided he could handle the constant background noise of the cafeteria better than he could the intrusive questions from Kiz Ryder. He understood where his partner was coming from. She wanted to choose their cases dispassionately from the thousands that were open. Her concern was that if they went down a path in which Bosch was exorcising ghosts or choosing cases with personal attachments, they would burn out sooner rather than later. But Bosch was not as concerned. He knew that passion was a key element in any investigation. Passion was the fuel that kept his fire burning. So he purposely sought the personal connection, or short of that, the personal outrage in every case. It kept him locked in and focused. But it wasn't the Laura syndrome. It wasn't the same as falling in love with a dead woman. By no means was Bosch in love with June Wilkins. He was in love with the idea of reaching back across time and catching the man who had killed her.
The killing of June Wilkins was as horrible as it was cunning. The woman was bound hands and feet with a dog collar and a leash, and then drowned in the tub. Her dog was treated to the same death. The autopsy showed no bruising or injuries on Wilkins, suggestive of a struggle. But analysis of blood and tissue samples taken during autopsy indicated that she had been drugged with a substance called ketamine hydrochloride, a veterinary sedative that acts as a paralyzing agent. It meant that it was likely that Wilkins was conscious but unable to move her muscles to fight or defend herself when she was submerged in the water in the bathtub. Analysis of the dog's blood found that the animal had been drugged with the same substance. A textbook investigation followed the murder, but it ultimately led to no arrests or the identification of a suspect. June Wilkins had lived alone. She had been divorced and had one child, a college student who went to school in Philadelphia. June worked as an assistant to a casting director in an office in a building at Hollywood and Vine, but had been on a two-week vacation at the time of her death. No evidence was found that she'd had an ongoing romantic relationship or that there were any hard feelings from a former relationship. It appeared to neighbors, acquaintances, co-workers, and family members that the love of her life was her dog, a miniature poodle named Frenchie. The dog was also the focus of her life. He was a pure breed, and the only travel Wilkins did in the year most recent to her death had been to attend dog shows in San Diego and Las Vegas, where Frenchie competed. The second bedroom of her bungalow had been converted into a grooming salon, where ribbons from previous dog shows lined the mirrors. The original investigation was conducted by partners Joel Spiegelman and Dan Finster of Wilshire Division. They began with a wide focus on Wilkins' life, and then narrowed in on the dog. The use of the veterinary drug by the killer and the killing of the dog suggested some connection to that aspect of the victim's life. But that avenue soon hit a dead end when the detectives found no indication of a dispute or difficulty involving Wilkins in the competitive world of dog shows. They learned that Wilkins was considered a harmless novice in that world, and was neither taken seriously by her competitors nor competitive in nature herself. The detectives also learned that Frenchie, though a purebred animal, was not a champion-caliber dog, and the ribbons he took home were more often than not awarded for simply competing, not winning. The detectives changed their theory and began to consider the possibility that the killer had purposely misdirected the investigation toward the dog show angle. But what the correct angle of investigation should have been was never determined. The investigation stalled. The detectives never linked the palm print on the bathroom wall to anyone, and lacking any other solid leads, the case was pushed into the wait-and-see pile. That meant it was still on the desk, but the investigators were waiting for something to break, an anonymous tip, a confession, or even another murder of similar method. But nothing came up, and after a year, it was moved off the table and into the archives to gather dust. While reading through the binder, Bosch had written down a list of names of people who had come up in the investigation. These included family members, neighbors, and co-workers of the victim, as well as acquaintances she encountered through veterinary services and the dog shows she attended. In most cases, Spiegelman and Finster had asked for birth dates, addresses, and even social security numbers while conducting their interviews. It was standard operating procedure. Their thoroughness back then would now help Bosch when he ran every name from the list through the crime computer. When finished reading, Bosch closed the murder book and looked at his list. He had collected 36 names to run through the computer. He knew he had the names and the palm print, and that was about it. He could also run ketamine hydrochloride through the computer to see if it had come up in any other investigations since 1972. He decided that if nothing came out of the three angles of investigation,
he would drop the case, admit defeat to his partner, and press on to the next case that had a valid hook. As he finished his coffee, he thought about the palm print. There had been no analysis of it, other than to measure its location on the wall and have it ready for comparison to suspects that might come up in the investigation. But Bosch knew that there was more to it than that. If the print was 66 inches up the wall, that meant it was likely that the man who had left it was over 6 feet tall. He came to this conclusion because he knew that if the suspect leaned forward to brace himself while urinating, he would probably put his hand on the wall at shoulder level or slightly above. Add a foot in height for his neck and head, and you have a man ranging from 6'2 to 6'6 in total height. A tall, left-handed man.
That narrows it down,
Bosch said to himself, noting his own sarcasm. He got up, dumped his coffee cup, and headed out of the cafeteria. On the elevator up to 5, he thought about the times he had leaned his hand on the wall over a toilet. He was either drunk, middle of the night sleepy, or burdened by something besides a heavy bladder. He wondered which of these conditions had fit the tall, left-handed man. Most of the police department's civilian offices were on the 5th floor along with the open-on-solve unit. He passed the unit's door and went down to the personnel department. He picked up contact information on Spiegelman, Finster, and his old partner, Eckersley. In years past, such information would be jealously guarded. But under order from the office of the chief of police, detectives with the open-on-solve unit were given carte blanche because it was part of investigatory protocol to contact and interview the original investigators of a case that had been reopened. Eckersley, of course, was not one of the original investigators. He was only there on the morning they had found the lady in the tub. But Bosch thought it might be worth a call to see if he remembered that day and had any thoughts on the reinvestigation of the case. Bosch had lost contact with Eckersley after he completed his street training and was transferred out of Wilshire Division. He assumed he was no longer on the job and was not mistaken. Eckersley had pulled the plug at 20 years, and his pension was sent to the town of 10,000 Palms, where he was the police chief. Nice move, Bosch thought. Running a small-town police force in the desert and collecting an LAPD pension on the side. Every cop's dream. Bosch also noted the coincidence of Eckersley now living in a town called 10,000 Palms, and the fact that Bosch was currently running an angle through a database of 10,000 palm prints. Ryder was not at her desk when Bosch got back to the unit. There was no note of explanation left on his desk, and he figured she had simply taken a break. He sat at her desk and looked at her laptop. She had left it on, but had cleared the screen before leaving the office. He pulled the list of names out of the murder book and connected to the National Crime Index computer. He didn't have his own computer, and was not highly skilled in the use of the Internet and most law enforcement databases. But the NCIC had been around for years, and he knew how to run names on it. All 36 names on his list would have been run through existing databases in 1972 and cleared. What he was looking for now was whether any of the 36 people had been arrested for any kind of significant or similar crime in the years after the June Wilkins murder.